Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 8, Episode 124. I am Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com and sitting in for my co-host David Todd, who remains in New York currently, is my partner in crime, Alex Kozura. Alex, happy Friday. Two weeks in counting.
Yeah, me and Tim will go to training camp. Tim will take some great pictures, and he's got a much nicer car than I do. So if I get to ride maybe from there to McDonald's with him, that's a highlight.
Yeah, and sometime in the next day or two, I think you're going to be putting up the annual kind of, you know, GoFundMe post. So anybody who, you know, if you've been listening to the podcast and if you have gone to the site for any considerable amount of time, I think you know the value of Alex's, you know, daily training camp reports. And then, of course, we try to do as many podcasts, special edition podcasts in the evening when he gets home from practice as well, too. So if you want to help support the cause and kind of ease our cost associated with all that, look for Alex to put something up on the site in the coming days as well, too. Alex, not a lot is happening news-wise right now with the Steelers, and when you look around the rest of the NFL and what has happened with the Steelers in the past, that's a good thing, you know. Now, we'll see what happens in the next couple days. Actually, this will be the last podcast until we find out you know, what the status of Le'Veon Bell will be. The deadline, of course, is 4 p.m. on Monday, the 16th, for the Steelers to sign him to a long-term deal. People ask me, you know, is there any sign that the Steelers and Bell are negotiating? There's no way for me to know the answer to that. I will say this, though. There probably will be one more quick conversation between the team, and I'm just speculating here, between now and Monday. And, you know, I think the Steelers probably already have their best deal out on the table right now. And, look, they're not – the last thing the Steelers are going to be bullied into a little extra money. They have a market value in mind that they believe Le'Veon Bell is worth, a guaranteed money structure. You know, it is what it is, and either he's going to take that or he's not going to take that. They're just not going to allow, I don't think, a player to kind of set any new precedent here. You know, as far as him being the highest paid running back, yeah, I mean, that could happen. But, you know, they're not going to break the bank on top of it. He's not going – I will be absolutely shocked if he does sign a deal that is much more – you know, it's either going to be around the franchise tag amount or less. I can't see it being the you know, 16, 17 million season, anything like that. And, you know, now we'll wait and see. Look, I mean, optimism is probably, you know, it has been low for quite a while, and really there's no sign whatsoever outside of what Bell said, you know, a couple weeks ago on NFL Network to think a deal is going to get done. My whole philosophy on this the whole time has been that Bell will listen to his mama.
Yeah, it's been a little flimsy, if you ask me, a little flimsy.
Yeah, you know, because, look, I mean, he is not going to be a Steeler past this season, barring something totally unexpected, if he does not sign a long-term deal by Monday. So, you know, his mama is a big Steelers fan. You know, whether or not he thinks that he can cash in and find a team that he thinks he could possibly win a Super Bowl with moving forward, you know, we'll see. But, you know, the Steelers' way of doing business is here it is, take it or leave it. And obviously, if he does not sign this deal by the 16th, then you're probably not going to see him until week one of the regular season.
You definitely won't see him, I think, until week one of the regular season. Something you said kind of caught my ear there, Dave. You don't think there's going to be a heavy discussion these next couple of days? You said they'll have a quick discussion, and that's kind of how you think. I know you're speculating, but you still don't think it's going to be a serious talk?
No. I mean, what's there left, you know? I mean, are you going to squabble over? I don't see what there's left to squabble over. I mean, it's been out there for going on 2 years now. I'm sure, you know, or I would think, I shouldn't say I'm sure, I would think that this year's best offer would be slightly higher than maybe the one that he received last year. And that assumes the numbers that were released, you know, or that were reported were true. I just don't see there being much negotiation being involved here because of, really, the Steelers have a certain way that they like to do contracts with these guys that don't play the quarterback position. And I just can't see it getting last minute them saying, oh, here's $2 million more, you know, along those lines. I just cannot see them doing that.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily what I mean. I would hope, maybe I'm wrong about this, maybe I'm ever the optimist, but they would have some sort of meaningful discussion throughout because, yeah, I mean, what's there to squabble about? I mean, apparently enough that a deal hasn't gotten done. Apparently there's enough, and it's obvious that, you know, both sides are too far apart, so there's still stuff to squabble over. That's kind of the agent's job is to squabble, the team to squabble back. And
it's the agent's job to run it, you know, run it close to the deadline. Or run it right up to the deadline to see if he can get a little bit more.
Okay? Right. My hope is this Monday they have a very serious talk throughout the day till 4 p.m.
Well, I mean, Aditi Bakari doesn't have a good history when it comes to trying to get franchise tagged running backs more money, you know. Now, if there's anything maybe to have optimism about is – you know, both Ray Rice and Matt Forte ended up re-signing, you know, but that was the first year of the tag with both those guys. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I understand Bell's side of it, you know, wanting to reset the market. And really, technically, he already has with a year of the franchise tag. And then, obviously, 2 years will total, what, nearly $27 million. That's a heck of a lot of money for a running back, you know. So
put a percentage on it. What are the odds you think a deal gets done?
I mean,
because you're the optimist one here. At least that's how it looks. I'm curious.
Right. I mean, less than, you know, I think I would be hard pushed. I mean, I would have a hard way. It'd be hard for me to justify putting more than 50% chance on it. I mean, for obvious reason. I mean, they did get a deal done last year. If, you know, assuming everything that's out there is true, which we know it's probably not, you know, assuming what we think he wants is at least $15 million a year, you know, assuming the Steelers aren't going to pay, you know, much more than that, I would put it under 50%. You know, I just think the harsh reality, I mean, it could be all, you know, and usually it probably is with players, all dollar signs and nothing else, you know. But how many times have we heard Steelers players over the years say the grass ain't always greener on the other side for a few more bucks and this, that, and the other. And you hear, you know, Jerome Bettis, not that it makes a damn bit of difference what these other players, you know, players say, because they're not the ones going through it at the time. I mean, if Jerome Bettis was a 27 or whatever year old Le'Veon Bell, he'd probably think Jerome Bettis, shut up, old man, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I really think Bell, you know, knows the Steelers are committed with the offensive line. He wants to play in Pittsburgh. You know, the thing is, I don't know how close the two sides need to be. You know, if Bell and his agent have a hard, fast number of, I don't know, 15 and a half, 16 million, you know, maybe it doesn't get done. But if they, you know, maybe a 13.5 or 14 million. I don't know how close this thing has to be. It might come down more to guaranteed money than anything, you know. Mm-hmm. But he should know that the Steelers have a good history, not that it means anything, a good history of paying out, you know, all of their long-term lucrative contracts for the most part. Now, are there some instances? I mean, we've seen the Lamar Woodley thing, and I mean, there are instances where they haven't. You know, Willie Colon, those kind of things where those big-time contracts don't all get paid out. But for the most part, when they make a commitment to the player, as long as he doesn't fall off the face of the earth due to injuries, they're going to keep him around. And the thing with Woodley and Colon is both those guys missed a lot of games due to injuries. You know, so I mean, you could not justify, and then that, and then you know, restructuring the contracts was throwing, you know, bad cap things on the other one there. I've said this all along, Alex. It's just kind of a gut feeling with me, these last whatever months, you know, that they would be able to get a deal done. Now, obviously, the closer you get to the deadline, you know, that's going to start shrinking there. But, you know, I'm still, whatever percentage you want me to put on it, I don't know. But I still have some level of optimism here.
Yeah, I mean, I still have some level, but I think less than you do. I mean, I to answer my own question, I would probably put it at about 15-20%, and I only have that because I believe that Bell wants to stay here. I believe that the Steelers want Bell to stay here, and they're acting in good faith, and that's at least a good basis for getting a deal done. But you know, I'm not going to rehash everything I've talked about before. You know, and the reasons are obvious why I don't think a deal will get done, but yeah, I'd be surprised, not shocked, not to get into semantics, but I just don't expect it to happen.
Now if they lowball him and say, you know, because you know Freeman making what eight?
Yeah, they won't do that.
You know, if they slap him in the face with a $10 or $11 million per year deal, then look, I wouldn't blame him, but I guess it, you know, the question is how close is close enough?
Yeah, you know. I mean, they've already offered, reportedly at least, and I assume that some of this is relatively true, $13 million. So they're not going to lowball them like that. They know the game and they know the time, and they're not going to act in that manner. I mean, it's going to be a competitive offer, and what they view, I think, is a really good offer, and I believe the fans will view it the same way. But you're right. The question is, what is Bell willing to take is kind of more the question than how high are the Steelers willing to go.
Right, and he should know that. I mean, look, I mean, if they sign him to a long-term deal now, I mean, he literally would have to have a catastrophic injury not to see past the 2018 season. And they generally like to build in these March kind of option roster bonuses, if you will, into these things. So, you know, assuming he stays healthy and can still walk come 2019, you know, he's going to get, by that March, he's going to get that option bonus and probably the one that comes after that in 2020. So he's going to see, you know, let's assume the first 3 years of whatever deal gets done totals out. What was the number last year? Was it 42 that was put out there? The first 3 years he was scheduled to make like 40, because it went 30 and then I think 42, something like that. So let's say the best offer this year has Bell being paid 45 or 48 million through the first 3 years. There's a good chance he's going to see that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, that's a, I don't know. I could, you know, I understand where he could possibly get more, you know, more than that on the open market next year. But, you know, it all comes down to, I guess the biggest thing will be is if he doesn't get a deal done with the Steelers, will the contract numbers leak, and how close, you know, how close will they have been to getting a deal done related to those numbers?
Well, I can't answer the second part of that question, but I can definitely answer the first. If the numbers will leak, Heck yes, 100%, likely from the team side of things. That's probably what happened last time, because, you know, it'll make the team look good and Bell look greedy for turning it down, which I don't, an assessment I don't generally agree with. But, yeah, the numbers reportedly in some form or the other will come out.
What will be, I mean, look, I mean, he does, because of past suspensions and because of this franchise tag and all like that and because of his rap songs and whatever, most Steeler fans probably want him gone, right? I mean, what would you put the percentage of even diehard objection, you know, really objectionable fans versus Joe Blow Yinzer off the street? Add all those together, what percent do you really think want to see Bell sign to a lucrative long-term deal here in the next, you know, by Monday?
That want to see him get a deal done?
Right, right.
I mean, I think the people, the anti-Bell camp is more of a vocal minority. I'd like to think that at least. So I think, you know, I think half the people would like to see this deal get done. I mean, of course, it all has to be done for the right price. But, you know, I think it's probably less of an anti-Bell thing than some of the, you know, Facebook comments I see make it out to be. But that's a good question. I can't give you a great answer.
They're going to, if they get a deal done, there's going to be, we're going to get, you and I both are going to get hit with that's way too much.
Mm-hmm.
whatever the amount is, it's already way too much.
Right.
Kind of thing here. So, look, you know, I hate to eat up 15 minutes of something we beat the horse to death, but I mean, there it is. That's our side of it. You know, like I've said all along, I'm not going to be shocked if a deal doesn't get done, but I probably have more optimism than most that it still will get done, just because it is such a drop dead deadline this time, because they're not going to franchise him with that quarterback number. I mean, this
right.
2018 will be it for Le'Veon Bell in Pittsburgh if something doesn't get done by Monday at 4 o'clock.
Yep, and for the record, I want to see the deal get done. I mean, count me in the people that would like to see a long-term deal get done with Bell, because I believe he's the best back in the NFL. I believe his value is immense and almost immeasurable. It goes far beyond what he offers as a runner. And my only caveat is that there obviously has to be a deal that 3 to 4 years from now you're capable of getting out of, where you're not going to be, you know, hammered with some sort of dead money that's going to cap strap you, you know, for when that time comes. And that's going to be difficult because, you know, obviously Bell's side of things, you know, you want to make sure you're getting paid too, and you have that long-term security. That's the whole point of the contract, whole point of these talks. So I want to see a deal get done. It can be for $16 million per year. I'm honestly fine with that. It just has to be that you can get out of that contract within 3 to 4 years.
Well, I mean, and that's why I think because they're prepared to carry his cap, his you know, what his cap number is now. And I've said all along, give him as big a base salary as you possibly can this year to go along with a signing bonus that'll put him up, you know, pocketing $17, $18, $19 million this year. You know, that's the incentive to sign the deal right there. And you can do so with keeping his cap number about what it was already going to be anyway. So that's a way to, instead of making a big chunk of that signing bonus, make as big of a chunk of it as you can as a base salary, and then go from there. Because whatever you give him more of in base salary versus signing bonus takes off, you know, a little bit of your risk factor when it comes to, you know, possible, you know, cap casualty or being on the hook for a lot of cap money later on down the line. But regardless, if they sign him to a deal, you're doing so with the idea that he's going to at least see the first three years of that deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would like, and you're better at this cap stuff than me, but yeah, kind of what you outlined for year one, year two, you can have a big, you know, biggish roster bonus in March with the base salary too. That's basically, you know, functionally guaranteed money as well. And, you know, I think the biggest issue for the team is that signing bonus. You want to keep that number down as much as possible. So again, you don't, you know, accrue that dead money 3-4 years if you have to, you know, cut them.
And here's the thing he needs to remember as well too. And I'm just spitballing numbers here, you know. He he could put $18 million, $19 million, whatever the number is, in his pocket this year, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously more than the tag number. And really, after 2 years, you know, if you look at, let's assume last year's numbers were right, $30 million, you know, through two, and I think it was actually probably a little bit more than $30 million. Let's assume, you know, let's say it's like $35 million this year. $35 million, you know, he's pretty much guaranteed to get in the first 2 years of this deal. That's awfully hard to turn down, right?
It would be. I mean, for you or I, yeah, it would certainly be. But again, if Bell wants to turn it down, I mean, that's his prerogative. I'm never going to blame a player for turning down money. If he thinks he can get more somewhere else, you know, you only get so many bites at the apple. So I'm not going to begrudge him for it. But yeah, I mean, logically, you think that's a really strong offer, because it is a really strong offer.
I think so, especially when it comes to the position that he plays. So, all right, you done? Let's put our sticks. let's put our sticks away. We've hammered this horse.
Put our sticks away. Is that a phrase? Is that an old timey phrase? I don't know.
Nah.
Is that a David?
You know, I guess now is a perfect time anyway to hit on this. Ron Johnson, former Steelers first round draft pick, way back. In the 70s, passed away this past week, and that was real sad to hear. I think he was 62. And you see, you know, when you're younger and you see the number 62, you think, man, that, you know, that's old. You know, 62 seems old. But let me tell you, when you turn 50, every year, I mean, every age seems very young. And you know, with that, me being 50 now, and you look at him being 62, you think, man, what a young, what a young age to pass away. And I didn't even know he was sick or was having any health problems or anything like that. But really is sad. Of course, two-time Super Bowl champion with the Steelers, won his first Super Bowl his rookie season, 1978 with the Steelers, and then again the following year was the youngest. The good thing about any of you listening that love, you know, the historical aspect and research, and I guess that's something that comes along with age as well too. Newspapers.com is absolutely fantastic. Now, you have to pay a subscription for it and all, but it is well worth it, I think, especially when it comes to going back and researching Steeler history. And I've done quite a bit of that, too, recently with my short series that I'm doing, the Remember This Player that I'm doing. I'm really uncovering a lot of things that I really didn't know about a lot of players this way. But you go back and read some of these older articles on Ron Johnson. He was, at the time, he was the first cornerback in the NFL to start and win a Super Bowl his rookie season. So that was quite an accomplishment there. I don't know why these kind of things stick in my mind, but immediately I went right back to the second Super Bowl he won with the Steelers against the Rams. That was January 1980. I was the ripe old age of I was closing in on my 12th birthday. I was already smoking at the time, if you can believe.
I'm not gonna ask what you were smoking.
Believe that, but I remember that final halftime drive, the Rams driving down the field, and them going after, getting on the Steelers side of the 50 and going after Ron Johnson twice. Back-to-back plays, sort of deep throws down the right-hand side of the field, and neither one were completed there. And another thing, he was actually credited with two passes defensed in the official game book of that Super Bowl. And then if you go to the second half too, there was a deep play downfield. Did you see me? Did you watch that play that I posted on Twitter? That deep play that he really was beat off the line of scrimmage, and he had to recover and get back in phase. You want to talk about having to get back in phase?
Right.
he got spun around, and really, you know, for him to get back in phase to defend that pass was something. You know, and I think that was a huge play in the second half of that game as well. So really was sad to hear him pass away so soon. And one of his sons, Ron Johnson Jr., is already, and I tweeted this out yesterday, if you're in the Michigan area, Detroit area specifically, I think his service is going to be this weekend, Sunday. I think visitation, I think the funeral on Monday. So you can find all that info on Twitter in my feed there. So I know you, it was way before your time, but you know, anytime a former Steeler passes away, especially one former first round draft pick, it really stand up and take notice.
Absolutely, and thank you for bringing it to attention of Steelers Nation, because honestly, I'm not sure if that story would have gotten out had you not found it on Facebook, because I saw basically everyone kind of citing you whenever they talked about it. It was even on Wikipedia as one of the deaths of 2018. So you know, I'm glad that you brought that, you know, to light, brought that to everyone's attention. And And I think his son seemed appreciative of it.
Yeah, normally I try to stay far away from breaking news on passings, you know, because you don't want a pro football talk thing to happen like what with Terry Bradshaw years ago and that kind of thing. But you know, a couple of his acquaintances, you know, on Facebook, and I was alerted to those by somebody, and they, you know, when you read the depth of how they described him going back to you know, youth football and that, you know, you just knew it was legit that he had passed away. So I would assume the full obituary can probably be found either today or by latest tomorrow on legacy.com as well too. It'll be interesting to see if they mention his time with the Steelers in there as well. So all right, moving on. One discussion you and I had the other day, and you know me, I'm like a bulldog when I get on certain topics. I won't leave it alone until I kind of finish it out. When you and I were talking about Ben Roethlisberger and red zone attempts into the end zone. I think that's how properly described it there. Well, I told you I wanted to look at a kind of a 3-year, you know, at least a 3-year study on this to see where Roethlisberger ranked, you know, because all we had is really his numbers to go on and nothing really to compare him to. So I got on it, Alex, with some data sets that I got a hold of going all the way back to the last 5 years to see where Roethlisberger ranked. And what I did is I compiled the stats of 14 other quarterbacks along with Roethlisberger. And, you know, 14 other quarterbacks, I want to make sure it was some that A, have been with their current team for the past 5 seasons and, of course, have been in a starting role, you know, as much as possible, because I think that'll give you a good kind of comparison tool there. Well, lo and behold, Ben Roethlisberger over the course of the last 5 years when it comes to red zone throws that went into the end zone completed 37.2%. And had a passer rating on those throws of 78.5. Really, when you stack him up to the other 14 quarterbacks, he's right in the middle of the pack. I mean, and especially when it comes to completion percentage and really quarterback rating as well, too. Now, Tom Brady really is an outlier, I think, when you look at these numbers. The fact that Tom Brady completed 48.7%. Percent of all red zone throws into the end zone is quite astonishing, as is his 84.8 quarterback rating as well. And probably not surprising when you think about Brady, because really this is a guy that is so damn good inside the red zone, and really one of the main, you know, for obvious reasons, one of the main reasons why the Patriots year in, year out are so good in the red zone as well too. So, you know, I guess the short answer to what we were wondering in the other podcast is Ben is about average when it comes to red zone throws into the end zone.
I honestly look at these stats, I look at them differently. I think that he's above average based on the numbers. The completion percentage, yes, is about average, but he's got 70 touchdowns, which is third of all quarterbacks, only behind Brady and Aaron Rodgers. He only has 3 interceptions. That was probably one of the most impressive numbers I saw from him, despite having the most attempts of any quarterback on this list. He only has 3 picks, and his quarterback rating, I believe, is second best, only behind Tom Brady. So yeah, the completion percentage is a little bit low, and again, I think that's kind of the gunslinger mentality that Ben has. But honestly, I think those numbers come out looking better than I thought that they might when we talked about this previously.
Right. I think I kind of hit on that at the end of the year. I was looking at just completion percentage, and that's where we were kind of hung up at on our last discussion. Was
yeah, but you threw the other numbers in, and they're really important.
Right,
I mean,
right,
70
right.
Touchdowns, 3 picks.
Exactly, and that's why I wanted to drill down like this. And I put, you know, look, the kind of stacking the quarterback formula on quarterback rating formula on this. I don't know if it's good or not. At least it gives you something that you can equally distribute throughout this. But the fact of the matter is, and I think it is a big fact, is that, you know, he has way, you know, well, I guess Philip Rivers, well, I don't know, Aaron Rodgers, he did, he does have the most attempts over the course of the 5 years. Now, Aaron Rodgers is right there with him.
And he would have had more had he not been hurt last year.
Right, right. He missed a full,
half a year.
And he technically has missed a full season, Aaron Rodgers has, during this 5 year span too. But Ben's missed, you know, how many how many games has Ben missed, you know, over the course of the last 5 years. Philip Rivers is right there with him as too. So it look, it's not surprising that Ben has the most attempts on this list, right? If I would have named these 15 quarterbacks ahead of time and said, who do you think has the most red zone end zone attempts over going back the last 5 years, you probably would have guessed Ben, right?
Yeah, he'd have been up there. Stafford as well. I mean, you could have gotten Brady, but Brady's so efficient. The ball gets in the end zone so often, he doesn't have the attempts because of it. But yeah, Breeze, Stafford, Ben would have been my guesses.
Right. Now, was I surprised the numbers were as high as they were with Ben? Yes, I think I was. I think that the fact that only 3 interceptions, I'm jinxing them now, ain't I?
Because you are.
We're going to get into 2018, and if he has a couple of red zone, end zone interceptions, people are going to point back to me jinxing. But look, no. These overall, when you look at the way these things are broken down, his numbers are not bad at all.
I think they're really good, yeah. I think they're above average. I mean, I'm curious. Those 3 picks, I mean, I get hung up on that number, but, man, you're efficient in the red zone. You're not turning the football over. You're maximizing points. That's huge, and I'm curious. 3 picks in 5 years. I wonder how many have come in the last 2 or 3 years from that. Maybe 1, maybe 2.
Well, you can name
I mean, we'll look it up.
You can name you should be able to name one.
Well,
of
the Jesse James, yeah.
Right, from last year against Buffalo. That's 1.
Well, no, I was saying the Jesse James the after the catch. Remember the pick there? The end of the game this year, 2017.
Right. Well, that's the one. Who is he trying to fit that into?
Eli.
Eli, right? So
yeah, you got the Buffalo one, like you said.
The Buffalo one with who is that? Preston?
Ladarius. It went to Preston Brown. It was for Ladarius Green.
Or was that for Jesse?
I'm pretty sure it was for Ladarius Green. It was miscommunication between the two, I want to say.
I thought that was the one for Jesse that he didn't get enough air on. To Jesse,
Maybe even thinking of something else.
Regardless, I think the second one against Buffalo. You know what? I'm having problems naming the third one.
And I mean, that could have been from 5 years ago for all.
Right. So, I mean, 2 of them were last year, right?
Right, and the one was super fluky because it was that end of the game chaos that is almost unfair to put that on Ben.
Right, but you still have to put it on there.
So. Well, yeah, I mean, you do.
Yeah, but so there you go. Now, I guess Pro Football Focus reads the Depot, don't they?
We start charging royalties.
Because not long after I started writing and talking about that, they put a very – you know, look, I like what they do, and I'll be the first to tell you, I subscribe – you know, our site subscribes to Pro Football Focus because I think a lot of what they do is very good. Now you get into the grading aspect of individual grading aspect. You know, look, there's some differences. You know, I take issue with several of their grades and all. But that aside, I think they do a lot of good stuff. What drives me crazy sometimes is they put out the most generic infographics, if you will, and there's just no context in them whatsoever. I mean, nor is there a link to a story where you can find it. You know, so they put out not long after we wrote and talked about end zone throws, the quarterbacks who threw the ball into the end zone the most in 2017. I mean, does that not scream, I read the depot? you know, anyway, Ben Roethlisberger, according to their numbers, Ben Roethlisberger is tied with Russell Wilson, 49 overall, with end zone attempt, throws into the end zone 2017. Now, keep in mind that these are all end zone attempts, so this is inside and outside the red zone. Yo, look, I was looking for something to write about, so thank you, Pro Football Focus. I did another five-year study with those same 15 quarterbacks and drilled down. There was no sense of me regurgitating my red zone, end zone attempt numbers. So what I did is I looked at throws into the end zone outside of the red zone, dating back the last 5 years. And once again, Ben sort of kind of right in the middle there. He was 33.3% on all throws outside the red zone into the end zone. Had obviously his 19 completions were all 19 touchdowns. Only three interceptions and a quarterback rating of 87.7. So when you look at Aaron Rodgers had the highest completion percentage, but only 25. I was a bit surprised by this. Even though the time that he's missed, only 25 throws into the end zone from outside the red zone. You think of him more as a gunslinger, right? I was a bit surprised that that number was so low with him. Now, Russell Wilson, not surprisingly, 48 total attempts. Philip Rivers, 50. Let's see, go through the list here. Cam Newton, his attempts outside the 20 were higher than what I thought I would find, as well as was his success rate. Cam Newton, surprisingly, a successful quarterback throwing into the end zone from outside the red zone. Only one interception, too. Those numbers kind of caught me surprised. You know somebody who's not good or doesn't like to throw for the end zone outside the red zone?
Tom Terrific, it looks like. My goodness.
And why would he? Really? You know?
Yeah, that's true.
15,
but still 5 of 33?
Yeah, 5 of 33. On throws into the end zone from outside the red zone. I was shocked. I mean, I wasn't expecting to see a high attempt number, but it's just not what he does. You know, he'd much rather paper cut you to death. Anyway, Ben, you know, how many of these were, look, we could go probably case by case here and then throw out probably five of each quarterback that probably was a catchable football. I think it's all relative when you go over a five-year sample like this. So overall, were you surprised by these numbers for this particular data set?
I mean, I think it's hard to be surprised by numbers because I just didn't have any expectations in the first place. I mean, I really just was like, show me the data and, you know, whatever happens, happens. I'm sure Ben's probably mad at Sammy Coates because Coates probably cost him about five touchdowns on this list and could have, you know, put Ben in first.
Hey, that's a good point. Wheaton probably responsible for one or two of those as well, too, in the end zone. Some catchable.
Right. I just remember all those incompletions, you know, to Coates. But, Leanne, like you said, it's all relative. All quarterbacks deal with bad receiver play, so it's not, you know, exclusive to Ben. But I think that the red zone study was more important because this one gets a little bit more into kind of an arbitrary gray area. And I thought that put the numbers on Ben in the red zone, throws in the end zone was critical. And I think that I can now comfortably say that Ben's one of the better, you know, red zone quarterbacks in the NFL. Probably him, Mariota, Brady. I'd have to look back at the list, but Breeze. Nah, Breeze wasn't even that good at it. But yeah, I think, you know, Ben, Mariota, who I know isn't on the list, but I know has good red zone numbers, and Brady are maybe the top three in the NFL.
You know, when you look, I guess if you were to take a five-year look at Ben Roethlisberger's completion percentage, overall completion percentage inside the red zone, it's not great. You know?
No, it's not.
But, you know, you can have an incomplete red zone throw on first down, and if that same drive, you're putting it in the end zone, it doesn't matter.
Right. For me, I just score touchdowns, don't turn the football over. And Ben has the third most touchdowns, the fewest interceptions, despite the most attempts. That's efficiency. That's productivity. That's really good in my book.
I guess what I'm getting at here is I think these last couple, this study this past week, makes Ben come off as not as bad of a red zone quarterback as I kind of envision him being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the numbers are super strong, and maybe that's gotten better over time. I'm not going to make you do more work, but I'm curious what Ben was like the first 5 years of his career. Maybe he was a lot worse because he just, again, even had that gunslinger mentality all the more. So it's really good. I'm glad you did the study, and hopefully fans learned a lot.
Well, I went back. You know, I was able to find, after we talked, one of the first posts I did was compiling his year-by-year numbers dating back to 2006.
Okay.
But once again, these are throws into the red zone or throws from inside the red zone or from the red inside the red zone to the actual end zone. So, you know, if it's first and 10 from the 19 and he throws the ball to the 1 yard line, that's not included in this study.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. So, you know, what way have I not attacked this yet that will help maybe uncover a potential red zone problem? I mean, would it be percentage of third down pass attempts inside the red zone that did not convert either into a touchdown or a first down? In other words, a stalling play. You know, is that a way to look at it? You know, or am I digging for something that probably just isn't there in general?
Yeah, that's what I was going to go with. I think you've done clearly enough of the legwork. And I think if eventually you look for a problem enough ways, you slice it up, you're going to find a problem. So that's kind of – I'd probably stand pat. I think you've done a pretty good job looking at the numbers.
Then where is the problem in the red zone then? Where is the problem in the red zone that it's enough that it's a glaring –
yeah.
Success rate issue that, you know, even going back for most of Ben's career, you know, regardless of the offensive coordinator, and one that we both agree Randy Feitner, one of the top things on his list this year is improved red zone efficiency. Where is the problem?
That is an excellent question, Dave. And I mean, I'm gonna go through the rest of my red zone study. I haven't picked it up since we last talked on Monday night. But, yeah, because, I mean, looking at those numbers, I mean, you could still blame Ben a little bit because everyone shares the blame. It's a team stat, but it's clearly Ben is not the primary problem with the red zone issues.
And being as how it goes over a span of just one offensive coordinator, you can't just put it on that.
No, it's not. It happened before Haley. It's happened the whole Tomlin era. It's not on any one player or any one thing. I mean, my brief look at some of the incompletions – in the red zone from last year, I thought some of the route combinations and some of the spacing was messed up. There were some individual issues with receivers, which is to be expected. But
you're going to see that over a five-year span with every NFL team.
Yeah, but I'm just looking at – well, I was looking at just last year. I'm just trying to find their problems, you know, regardless of what other issues other teams are having, if you can fix some of the spacing concepts. I mean, they had plays where they ran, like, all slants. Everybody just runs to the middle, and everything's just bunched up, and you got, you know, nine defenders in the way. That's not conducive to success. So, I mean, I'm talking about that kind of stuff when I talk about some of the spacing problems.
All right. Anything else to add on red zone? I mean, we have plenty of time to start dissecting that a little bit more. One other quick stat that I cobbled together here, kind of based off of talking about deep passes and all. The Steelers' pass defense last year had gave up this had against them the second highest quarterback rating in the NFL when it came to passes, deep passes of 20 yards or longer down the field. Is that surprising to you?
Nope, not at all. I don't think it's surprising to anyone that watched this team, especially the last 6 weeks of the season. They got burned over the top time and time again.
25 of 61, according to my numbers, during the regular season on passes, 20 yards or further down the field, 41% completion rating. That's too high. 8 TDs, that's too high. Only 3 interceptions. Like to see that be about 5 or 6. Here's the thing, and this should not be a surprise. 238 yards worth of yak on those 25 completions. Of the 959 total yards that those 25 completions resulted in, basically nearly 25% of those yards came after the catch. And here's something. I love intended air yards. That's my new hot stat now. Hot take stat here. Here's the funny thing about the those 25 completions, Alex, last year were made on average at the Steelers' 31.5 yard line. Okay, so it wasn't like these things were bombs down the field getting completed inside the red zone. You know, the average spot, 31.5 yard line. And how many times did we see last year these long completions not only get completed, but, you know, missed tackles after that, after the fact, that led to the player standing in the end zone?
Right, Tomlin talked about that. Got to get guys on the ground. Mike Mitchell talked about that, and then didn't do that. Had his own problems with it. Yeah, 238 yards a yak is the highest of any NFL team. Only two other teams, Washington and New England, allowed 200 yards a yak, and a lot of that just from blown coverages. The Colts game, the Packers game, I think had given up those kind of big plays where no one's in the vicinity, and of course you're going to give those up. So it's a fixable problem. You know, it's all about communication, which was poor and created so many of these problems last year. But yeah, it's an ugly, ugly stat. And at least you're not an Oakland Raiders fan. They look terrible, but Pittsburgh does not look much better.
Right. The thing I think something optimistic to take away from this stat is the fact that they were beat, but how many of these wouldn't have ended up? I mean, at least half of these drives that these big plays happen with probably don't culminate in touchdowns if a tackle's made before the player gets into the end zone.
Mm-hmm. That's true. My optimism just comes less from that and more from that. I think it was a big part of it was communication breakdowns. It just gave up the easiest chunk plays in the world, and I think that's fixable. I believe it's not a physical talent issue where guys are just getting straight beat.
A year from now, Alex Cazora, will the Steelers have had a lower completion percentage, given up a lower completion percentage than 41% on throws of more than 20 or more yards down the field? And will their quarterback rating against, it's 107.4. Boy, man, you look at a quarterback rating. You know how hard it is to get a quarterback rating of 107.4 on 61 throws, attempts of 20 yards or more down the field? I mean, that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave up 107.4. Will both those numbers be lower this time next year when we talk about the stat?
God, I hope so, Dave. It needs to be. I'll say that much. I think it will be, because I think it'll just kind of regress, and it can't be that much worse, and hopefully the communication does get better, the tackling gets better, and that'll pick those numbers up a bit.
The Oakland Raiders gave up 9 touchdowns on such plays and had zero interceptions. You look at that quarterback rating, 130.2. Gruden's got his hands full. With that defense this year, right?
Both teams with new defensive back coaches, so not a surprise there.
Right, right. So was Woodson with them last year or no?
Yeah,
was that the year before?
No, it was last year.
Kind of funny. Two former Steelers defensive backs
right.
were the defensive backs coach.
That's
right?
Funny.
Yeah. Yikes. I expect those numbers to be better. Look, there's no way they're going to win a Super Bowl, I don't think, if those numbers aren't better, if you ask me. Here's a funny thing about what stands about these rankings that I did when it came to that stat is that 8 of the top 10 teams in lowest quarterback rating allowed on passes of 20 yards or longer made the playoffs last year.
Yeah. Hey, if you can keep a lid on things, you're good on third down, you win the turnover battle, you win field position, you're going to win games. It's pretty simple formula.
Don't give up big plays. Get more big plays than your opposition gets, and don't let the big plays that you give up end up in the end zone. That's it. That's
Sounds easy, doesn't it?
that's the secret right there.
Yep.
Okay, you wanted to talk a little bit about some other grades at Pro Football Fo- or what?
No, I'll take it. Yeah, Bob Labriola asked and answered.
Oh, that's it.
Just real quick, because I don't want to harp on it too much, because we talked about Bud Dupree and T.J. Watt flipping sides, but you know, people are saying this is a good move. I don't really see the impact positively or negatively. I think it almost feels more of a desperation move, though, when people are trying to spin it. You know, Bob's answer, I think, kind of sums up that this move is kind of desperate, because it's hard to come up with the super good reasons for why this is a good move or really going to be beneficial to Dupree. Because, you know, Labs gets asked, you know, do you think it's going to be a good thing for Dupree to flip sides? And Labriola says Dupree plays at 270 pounds. I don't think he plays at 270 pounds, which seems to me make him better suited to be working along the line of scrimmage and attacking the backfield. Watt is close to 250, and based on the plays he made in space last season as a rookie, he seems to have an aptitude for playing in space. Traditionally, the right outside linebacker position within the Steelers' defense has been manned by the unit's best pass rusher, Joey Porter, James Harrison, and so putting Dupree there could turn out to be playing to his strengths. That's a bunch of word salad if I've ever heard it, Dave, to be honest. And I just don't know what putting Dupree on the right side makes him magically better because he's on the right side. That's not a thing. So, you know, again, hopefully Dupree turns the corner. But I think if he does, it's going to be for reasons other than the side he's playing on.
Bob Labriola is a great historian, a great writer, does a lot of great things. I like a lot of what he does, but X's and O's is not his thing. And I'm with you. This is just this is manufacture optimism that just there's no reason to think that this is going. If there's any optimism whatsoever, it's the fact that T.J. Watt might have a few more favorable matchups. That's about it.
Yeah, and even then, with the way tackles are, right tackles are just as good as left tackles in pass pro. Look at the Steelers. Gilbert, to me, is a better pass protector than Villanueva. And so for, you know, Labriola to say Dupree's now playing right outside, which is generally the weak side of the formation, how's that going to make him, you know, if Watt's better in space, you generally want him on the weak side where he's playing in space, not playing on the tight end side, playing kind of in less space. So why would you want Dupree to flip away from the tight end and want to get closer to the tight end more often? So that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And then the idea that the right outside linebacker is the best pass rusher, is Dupree the best pass rusher? No, Watt's already better, and putting on the right side does not magically make him. If I'm the right outside linebacker, I promise I'm not the Steelers' best pass rusher, so it doesn't do anything.
Yeah, Keith Butler's saying quarterbacks could see him coming. I mean, that,
at least that's some sort of an answer. It's a better answer, but it's not a good one.
It's not a good one. Nobody wants to be more wrong about Bud Dupree than you and I.
And I was high on Dupree this time a year ago. I was saying this guy's going to hit double-digit sacks. It's going to be the breakout. He's working with Chuck Smith, and it didn't happen. And so I'm not going to be as confident this time around. I still think he can become a talented player. I think injuries hurt him more than we're led to believe last year. I mean, he got really beat up with that shoulder injury, but I don't think putting him on the right side is going to really help him. I think, if anything, honestly, it could hurt him if they're going to ask him to drop the way they asked their right outside linebackers to traditionally drop. So I just it made me laugh a little bit.
Yeah, look, I mean, and make no mistake about it, they've got to get more. You know, I'm not just going to just say sacks. Sacks will be a byproduct of a consistent good four-man rush. It's just a byproduct of it, whether it be quality sacks, 3.5 second sacks, or whatever. But they've got to get more consistent play from their outside linebackers. We've been saying, it seems like we've been saying that since 2010.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. If they're going to, they've got to have these pressure and sack numbers get up. They've got to get teams more in these 3rd and 7 and 8, 9 yard situations there where these guys can just tee off on them and get after them, and the sacks will follow. But I'm sure Keith Butler is proud of that sack number last year that they got, but you go look at each one of them individually there, and the amount of them that came against Cleveland and the Texans, all you think, my appetite's still a little bit wet here when it comes to that.
So is mine. But yeah, I don't want to harp on it too much. Maybe, you know, we'll see what happens. I don't want to rag on Labriola was asked a question. He didn't just come up with it and say it out of thin air, but I didn't agree with the answer at all.
Bucky Brooks is at it again. He projects 3 picks for Terrell Edmonds during his rookie season. Seems a little optimistic to me.
A little bit, but I guess, you know, I expect Edmonds to be the dime defender, so he's going to be out there for big passing downs, 3rd and 5+, so there's going to be a chance for that, but 3 is a little strong for my taste.
If he does, what a great problem it is to have. If he gets 3, there's going to be some other people with some decent interception numbers, I think, as well, too, maybe, you know, but a little strong, I think. Look, I mean, who are the candidates to be the team's rookie of the year? The annual, Joe Green Award, if you will. It's like it is every year. It's Edmonds. I mean, it's the 1st and 2nd round pick. It's Edmonds and James Washington.
Yeah, but I'd lean Washington because he's going to have probably a starter role right away, while Edmonds is going to be in more sub-package.
I agree. He has a potential, too, of putting up numbers similar to Juju.
Yeah, and hopefully some of those – in a different way, and some of the big play capacity is going to be the big ticket for him.
Are you concerned about him trying to reproduce the numbers put up by Martavis Bryant last season?
I mean, it's always going to be that concern just because you never know exactly how the guy's going to adjust. Washington has to be what Bryant was the last month of the season as opposed to what Bryant was the first 12 weeks of the season, because, you know, that offense faltered when Bryant was rusty and just wasn't himself. And when he got going, the rest of the offense kind of followed. So that's what Washington has to be, and there's going to be a concern for that. Can he really truly be a burner at 4.54, speed? Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. I think he'll have a good year, and hopefully he can be that guy. But yeah, he's a really critical cog for year one guy.
Martavis Bryant, the final 4 games of the 2017 season, 6 catches for 33 yards. That's not a big deal there. That was against the 6 catches looks great because you hardly see him catch that many games during a game there. The 4 for 59 against New England and the touchdown was obviously good. The 3 for 60, I mean, who cares? 3 for 60 against Houston. He had a big, what do you have, like a 36 or something long one in that game there. And close out the regular season 6 for 65 against Cleveland. Now, against Jacksonville, you had a couple of nice long ones in the playoffs, 2 for 78, and obviously the late touchdown as well, too. So how many of his catches came, during the final 4 games of the season? That's 6 and 6 is 12, and 7, 19. I did that in my head. Didn't have to take my shoes off for that.
Hey, good job. But they were just big plays. It's less about the volume of catches, but what you do with them. You know, Bryant was never going to be a 10-catch guy, and to get 6, like we said, is almost a minor miracle. But you're creating big plays. You're averaging 20 yards per catch. You're getting touchdowns. You're that Jacksonville game. You're catching 40-yard bombs. That's the component of Bryant that was so valuable to this offense.
All right, during the first half of the season where it looked like Martavis and Ben really weren't on the same page when it came to the deep ball, Martavis caught, 5, 10, 15, 18 balls through the first seven games. Will James Washington have more than 18 reception? Basically, will James Washington have better stats through the first seven games of the 2018 season than Martavis did through the first seven games in 2017?
Yes, he will, and man, I really hope he does. If he didn't, something's going wrong with his offense.
And Martavis only had one touchdown in those first seven games.
Yeah, a lot of missed opportunities.
And just remember that, you remember the deep ball against Minnesota? Just that should have been seven right there.
Chicago, to open up Chicago.
Chicago, was it Chicago or Minnesota? What was the one?
Well, it might have been both, but it was definitely Chicago on the first series of the game for Pittsburgh.
Right. You just failed to connect, and there were times where Ben, in that Ben grimace, where it looks like Martavis either gave up or didn't. Martavis did something wrong that did not make Ben happy.
Yeah, and I don't think it was always an issue of giving up, but there was just issues with his technique and his routes. It was what against the Bengals, I think Ben talked about on his on during the week. The one time that Bryant looked way too early for the ball, looked too late, I forget which, and couldn't locate it in time. That was when people thought he gave up on him, but he just basically ran the route incorrectly, and that caused the incompletion.
Right, right. And Ben's not afraid to point some of those things out at times either.
Yeah. So I think Washington will be a pretty technical, detailed guy. And yeah, he's a rookie, and that's going to have some hardships. But I think he'll be a more detailed guy than Bryant's been.
All right. What else do we have?
The offensive line. We got to do a
position group. Position group. Let's see. Marcus Gilbert is a guy that if he stays on the field, I think he's been snubbed in past season. We've talked a little bit about him before. If he stays on the field, one would expect him to have a Pro Bowl slash maybe even a first team All Pro season. And if we're not talking about either that happening or him getting somewhat screwed, we have a problem.
Yeah, last year was difficult, but this year's, new year, he should be able to bounce back as long as health is there. He's, like you said, when he's healthy on the field, he is a Pro Bowl caliber player and one of the best, linemen on a team with full good linemen.
Right, and if we're talking anything other than, Marcus Gilbert played all 15 of 16 games and didn't live up to. We have a problem if that happens, and then we have to call into question, downside of the career, worth the money, blah blah blah. From there, I'm not worried about. I think he looks great. I think if he stays on the field, that'll happen. On the other side, Alejandro Villanueva, I'm comfortable with him.
Yeah, I've been happy with his body of work. The biggest thing for him, and I wrote about this about a week or two ago, was he's got to start faster to the year. And I don't know what the issue behind that is, if that is truly coincidence or if he's just kind of a guy that takes time to get the cobwebs out and to kind of bounce back. But the last 2 years, he's given up basically the same number of sacks the first month of the year as he gives up the rest of the year, give or take a half sack or so. So he's got to find ways to get off the faster starts. And after that, he's golden. So, he's such a strong guy. He plays with violence in his hands. And when they let him kind of be more the aggressor and quick set and jump set guys, rather than just kind of a traditional kick slide catch, he's really excellent. And he's got that great chop that he does and knock down hands and throw guys to the ground. So he's a lot of fun to watch. He's gotten a whole lot better, but he's just got to get off to a better first month of the season.
And he's going to ride out a shoot against Myles Garrett, right?
Yeah, so that's going to be tested pretty quick.
And then Kansas City, I'm trying to look. I mean, they're going through some adjustment there now. Houston.
D-Ford's still there?
I think D-Ford's still there, but Tom Bahali,
gone.
He's gone now.
He's about to retire, yeah.
And what about, Houston's up there in age now, too. I mean, not the same player he once was.
They got some good guys. They got Chris Jones. They got K-Pass. I think they've, let me check that. But, yeah, they got some pass rushers.
With Tampa, who's Tampa got over there getting after it now?
Well, they won't see much of McCoy. They have JPP, and they have JPP this year.
Do they? Yeah, I Baltimore Ravens week four, then Atlanta, then Cincinnati. So, like, he'll get a decent test right out of the gate there. All right, guard. Look, I mean, what's there to say about David DeCastro? One of the best in the league. Expect that to continue. Will there be any drop off with Ramon Foster? Pro Football Focus didn't care for Foster's play last year.
Well, they didn't seem to care for Pouncey's play either, so I call that into question a little bit. Yeah, with Foster, could there be a decline? Maybe. Yeah, it's going to happen.
There could be, yes.
You think it's you think it's a hard yes?
I think it's a hard yes just because he's up there in age. And this is a guy, too. Remember, he's had problems playing all. I mean, he's usually good to miss a couple of games. You know, and he has that kind of that bigger – But yeah, he's not swelt, if you will, like no. The rest of the guys. What if you're to line the five starters up and say one of these guys don't belong? It's Foster.
Probably, yeah, but that's a good group of guys to be lined up against.
Sure.
You know, the worst of a good group of five can still be pretty good. And you know, to get to the point, the decline could happen because eventually it will happen. It's just natural. But I haven't seen really any evidence of it. So it's hard to predict it because I haven't seen really any decline in his play, to be honest with you.
And I think the thing that we say year in, year out with Ramon Foster is he's probably the most underrated guy on the offensive line because he's so damn consistent. He doesn't get beat often to the inside. He showed he can pull some in the past as well, too. He's just Mr. Consistent. It's not flashy. It's not probably not going to get him to a Pro Bowl or first-team All-Pro, but up until now, this starting five I'm not worried about.
No. Will, one last question on Foster, then we'll move on. Will Foster be a Steeler in 2019?
I don't think he will, Alex. I don't think he will. I mean, it would have to be an ultra cheap. It's not gonna happen. But I don't think between now and training camp, and it would have to be another one of those. I'm giving you a heck of a bargain. We're signing you for 3 years, even though you're probably only gonna play one kind of deal.
It's a tough one for me. You can definitely argue that he won't be back. I'm gonna say that he will be back though.
And it's all predicated on how he plays, you know, if you miss, you know, how he plays this year. I mean, plain and simple, if he misses 3-4 games because of whatever, it's tough, you know, it's going to be. Now, maybe he's the kind of guy that you expose out there to free agency and you go about your business and then come middle of July, he's not signed. He's signing for a minimum. I doubt it gets to that. You know, kind of thing. I just, my gut feeling tells me he won't be back. Looking at the backups behind him real quickly, B.J. Finney, I've always liked him better at guard, at left guard, than I have at center. It'd be interesting to see if he can improve his play at center during the preseason and make us feel a little bit better about that. But as far as backups go right now, I have no issue with him. Matt Filer showed us some things last year during the preseason. He'll be another fun guy to watch this preseason as far as where it comes to getting time at either guard or tackle. Hubbard no longer there. Chooks is going to be a guy that's really under the rookie third round pick. Going to be a guy that's really under a microscope for you and I think during the preseason here. And geez, who else? I mean, is there going to be a ninth offensive lineman kept this year, and who's it going to be?
Well, we've had that discussion before. Currently, as the roster stands, I don't believe that they will. Someone's going to have to play their way onto the roster. I think in my mind, I think this team's going to be comfortable with eight, with you know, core four, with them liking him, Finney, who's versatile in the interior, Filer, who's I think can pretty much play anything but left tackle if he gets some extra work at center. So I think you're comfortable with eight. So if a Jake Rogers or a Bryce Harris or somebody else makes it, that's fine. But I think I'm going into camp with the mindset that they're keeping eight and a ninth guy has to prove it.
Are you fine with the eight? I mean, here we are. We're supposed to be previewing, you know, let's assume it's eight. How are you with the eight?
I'm pretty comfortable with it. I mean, of course, we got to see what Okorafor does and where he's at in his career. But just because he's a rookie and just because he's relatively raw does not mean that he can't play well. Gerald Hawkins was pretty raw coming out of college. He missed some time. I think he came out as a junior. He had a really strong training camp before he hurt his shoulder. So, you know, I'm not going to assume anything about Okorafor of what he can and can't do. And he's working with some of the best coaches in football, like Munchak and Sean Surrett. So I'm confident in that. Filer's done a nice job. Finney's proven himself. They have that next man up mentality with great coaching that puts him in position to succeed. So, you know, losing Hawkins hurt, losing Hubbard hurt, but I think this team has the depth to withstand that.
Best top eight come the start of the regular season when it comes to offensive linemen. I mean, you could make an argument that their starting five is top five in the league, right? So if you went that far, are Finney, Filer, and Okorafor, sounds like a law firm, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do they add enough that would say, look, I'd stack this top eight up against any top eight in the league?
I think it's close. The depth may not be perfect, but here's my thought on the depth, Dave. I don't think there's many teams that can lose their best backup offensive lineman, Hubbard, to free agency, that can lose a promising tackle for an injury and still have good depth. And the Steelers have good depth despite losing those two guys in pretty quick succession.
I'm really excited to see these other three play during the preseason. We know who the other five are. Mm-hmm. You know, so and look, Filer is a guy that I'd really like to see him play some more, some right tackle, I think, right? I mean, because we know he can play left guard. I mean, right guard, right? I want to see him play some right tackle more, possibly during the preseason.
I would too. I mean, I still want to see all spots just because, you know, you want to continue the evaluation and even center some. But if he could play right tackle and if you can get Okorafor to kind of focus, I mean, Okorafor is going to play both, but if you can kind of get him to focus more of a left tackle as the season starts, then that's kind of going to be your one spot where you can kind of really hone in on that. And if you can get Filer to be the right tackle, I think that's going to help both those guys. So that's kind of the ideal situation, but we'll see how they divvy it up. Because I don't know how much time Filer's going to get. He's going to get some, maybe a tackle, but it's a lot of guys that need reps.
Well, here's the thing. Okorafor, are you going to be surprised if any of his reps come other than, you know, left tackle during the preseason? I mean, I want to get him as much work as possible at left tackle.
I do, too. I mean, he's going to play both in camp because you always move those guys around because you got to have some flexibility. And he's already said he's worked both. So I think in the games it's going to mostly come at left tackle. Could he play some right to get him some reps there? Because you don't want to go into a season where he hasn't gotten any reps at right tackle in a game, and if something happens during the game where Filer's checked in at guard and, you know, a tackle goes down, Gilbert goes down, you want Chooks to have some work there. So I think you're going to see somewhat right, but I think 75% of the snaps will come on the left side.
All right, other than Villanueva and Okorafor during the preseason left tackle, who else do you expect to see get time at left tackle?
Well, Jake Rogers can play tackle spots. I think Bryce Harris will mostly play on the right side. I think Rogers can play the left, and whoever else they put in there, whether that's a Joseph Cheek or, you know, someone like that, that's not going to make the 53.
All right. Okay. I think we hit that nail square on the head with a hammer, right?
Well, any of the other, you know, third team guys you want to talk about? RJ Prince, I know you're kind of high on him.
I want to see position versatility from Prince. I, you know, obviously I don't. I think he's a long shot. It's going to take something to happen, I think, for Prince to make the 53. A couple injuries or two. I am interested to see him play some guard, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I think he's going to be a guard only. I think left, right guard. I mean, I know he's kind of listed as a tackle, but he really did none of that at UNC. He's an interior guy that's a little bit tall, but has length, strength, and I think a little bit better lateral mobility than you would expect from a guy of his size. Patrick Morris, I'm super high on. I think that's the guy that could
That's the kid that's going to be fun to see later in games at center, I think.
Yep, center, potential guard as well. Heck of an athlete. That's a guy that has practice squad material written all over him with potential to start. I think he can become a better version of BJ Finney someday. Some of the other guys, you know, we don't know a ton about. Chris Schluger has played both guard spots. He's a pretty versatile guy at UAB. I think Larson Graham's gotten work at guard after being a tackle at Duquesne. Cheek played tackle in college. That's kind of the most of them. So, you know, it, guys that, you know, unlikely to make the team, but I'm always interested to check those guys out as well.
You know, if there's one of those initial undrafted free agents that I still haven't been able to go, you know, watch a large selection of games of, it's Patrick Morris. And this is a guy, too. This guy might end up being like Finney, though, right, where he might be a better guard than he is a center?
Maybe, but honestly, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any great reason to think one way or the other. I think he could be successful at both, and I think he'll get time at both, maybe more center than guard, but it could just depend on the numbers, what other guys can do. If, say, Parker Collins, they feel like Collins can only play center best, and that might move a guy like Morris more to guard. So I'm not going to put any of these guys into a box before we start seeing some action with them.
Matt Filer looks like a Steelers offensive lineman.
He's got that big beard. Yeah, he's old school.
All right, anything else you want to add about this group? I mean, I'm excited about this group, quite honestly, and you know, past the starting five, too.
Yeah, I think it's a good group. I think, again, great teaching, physical training camp. That's perfect for the big uglies up front. So, yeah, I'm excited to watch them, but that's all I had to add.
All right, what else do we have to get to? Anything here?
I think that's everything for me. I posted, speaking of offensive line play, I had to post today, Jonathan Scott's butt block from 2011. So thank your lucky stars, Steelers line does not have to endure butt blocks anymore.
Well, you know, and going back and thinking about some of these offensive lines over the years, I mean, you go back and you look at what they made the Super Bowl with in 2008,
yeah.
And really, for that matter, 10 as well, right?
Stapleton and Mahan and Hartwig. Kimiatu, was he a part of that 08 team?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, 2010, I think he was, right? You go back and look at some of the injuries and piecemealed things that they've won a couple of Super Bowls with in 2008 and 2005 and 2008. It's just, and remember, Pouncey couldn't play in the Super Bowl against the Packers because of the anchor. Ligurski had to start there, and didn't Jonathan Scott start at left tackle that in that Super Bowl?
God, did he? If he did, I blocked that out of my memory. That'd be the Packers one. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Let me try to look that up if I know we're running out of time, but I'm curious. Yeah, I'll go through the offensive line.
We have plenty of time. It's a podcast.
That's fair. Well,
I'll tell you real quick whether or not he started. Starting in that Super Bowl was Jonathan Scott at left tackle, Chris Kimoatu at left guard, Doug Ligurski at center, Ramon Foster at right guard, and Flozell Adams at right tackle.
How did that team go to a Super Bowl?
Yeah. Do you know who were the backups in that game? Were Tony Hills?
Oh my God.
Trey Essex. Those are the two guys that dressed. Those are the only two offensive linemen that dressed as backups in that game. So we were a snap away from Hills and Essex playing in that game. Not active for that game was Chris Scott. Tennessee kid.
Oh, Tennessee, yeah.
Former fifth-round pick.
Fifth-round pick, yeah.
Brooks. Was it Donovan Brooks? Dorian Brooks.
Yeah,
Dorian Brooks.
James Madison, was that him? God, Dorian Brooks was active? Was on the
roster? No, he was inactive for that. Him and Chris Scott were inactive for that game for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I think Dorian Brooks from James Madison. Yeah, that's really ugly. And then I looked for the Cardinals one in 08, it was left to right. Starks, Kimiatu, Justin Hartwig, Darnell Stapleton, and Willie Colon was your starting five, which is better, but not by much.
And Super Bowl XL, Marvell Smith, who I think battled some injuries that year, right? Fanica, Jeff Hardings, Kendall Simmons, and Max Starks.
Yeah, and that was a good line, and especially for the run-first mentality. They had those big guys up front that could move, so that was well-suited for the team.
not dressing for that Super Bowl offensive line wise was Kimo Atu and Trey Essex.
Spared Brooks on that team? He was. He dressed too.
He dressed.
Did he?
Yeah, he dressed for that Super Bowl. And Chucky Okobie.
Hey, another rapper.
Was the two offensive linemen to dress for that game. All right. I think that's got us for this time. We know we'll be talking quite a bit about on Tuesday. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at SteelersDeep. You can follow Alex Cazora on Twitter at Alex_Cazora. Follow my co-host David Todd at David M. Todd. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and you want to donate to the cause, go to SteelersDepot.com. Hit that donate button, upper right navigational bar. And until Tuesday, as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.